Cool. Well, hopefully I don't need to convince people attending the socialism conference that capitalism is fucked. But I think the kind of solution to this fucked system that we live in is still definitely up for debate, even among people who agree that there's something wrong. And I think it's quite basically recurrently popular on the left to talk about mutual aid as being a really important sort of strategy. I think a lot of the time it's actually extremely vague what people mean by this. So, sometimes Stalinists, like in the Australian Communist Party, they, might hand out lentils and call that mutual aid. Some people might say that Max Chandler Mather's sausage sizzles and free breakfast are mutual aid. Some people in like the US like fill potholes and call that mutual aid. So clearly, this is a strategy that can be kind of taken up and spoken about by quite a wide range of people. And it's definitely not inherently done by radicals. So I think the relevance for socialists is because it's common on the left for people to talk about it. But I think very specifically, because it's presented as an alternative to building political organizations and talking about socialist politics. So I'm going to be talking today about mutual aid as a strategy. So sometimes, like, and this again speaks to kind of the vagueness. Sometimes people say, like, when people spontaneously like shovel mud after a natural disaster, this is mutual aid. I'm not talking about just helping people as mutual aid. I'm talking about it as a strategy for people on the left who actually want to resist the system. And terms you'll hear from people who talk about mutual aid and advocate for it are things like community and resource sharing, that by focusing on our neighborhoods and our communities and using them to build resistance to the system, that is the strategy we have to take up. So Dean Spade, who's basically one of the most well-known kind of proponents of mutual aid, he wrote a book about mutual aid in 2021. And he describes mutual aid as a strategy for meeting survival needs, building movements and building self-reliance. I think this is pretty broad and good definition, but there's a range, I think, and a kind of diversity of opinion of those who advocate for mutual aid from the more to the less theoretically worked out, and definitely from the more right wing to the more kind of left sounding. So I'm going to try and talk about the general problems as well as more explicitly specifically addressing particular arguments. So to organize this kind of big task, I'm going to split up the talk into three sections and kind of compare in each of them the mutual aid approach versus the Marxist approach. And I think it's important for any strategy to be able to answer these three questions. Firstly, why is the world the way it is? Secondly, how can we fight back? And finally, what is the ultimate overarching solution to the problems of capitalism? And what I hope is that by the end of the talk, and hopefully a very vibrant discussion, I will show you that mutual aid and Marxism aren't two things that kind of you can do half of, one half of the other, but actually that they are opposed strategies that look towards different forces. And what I hope is that I will show how revolutionary Marxism is the only theory that has a strategy that can actually defeat capitalism once and for all. So, onto this first question, why is the world the way it is? Well, obviously, those who advocate for mutual aid can acknowledge and do that there is extreme inequality that is just always increasing in capitalism, but they have a very different diagnosis of the issue. And I think, well, it's not that funny, but it's funnily enough, it is hard to describe what proponents of mutual aid actually say about why the world is the way it is. They kind of dodge the question a lot of the time. And I think this is actually reflective of the politics. There's a general tendency to think on a very small scale when talking about mutual aid. And I think even when injustice is observable in a community or a neighborhood, the reason why that injustice exists is and often is obscured. And I think this is quite often a purposeful distortion. It's not like capitalists go out and say, I'm really rich because I love exploiting people. And it's not like the state says the police exist to, bash workers up and, shut down homeless camps. It's a purposeful distortion about why the institutions of capital, operate in the way they do. And I think similar for why injustice exists. But some of the reasons that, people who talk about mutual aid kind of describe are individual greed, reliance on the state or the system and kind of the resulting passivity of, the masses to resist, and kind of an abstract thing about hierarchy. I think Marxists have a very different starting point for why the world is the way it is. We say that capitalism is a class system, and the two main classes are the working class and the ruling class. How we understand what class someone is by their relationship to the means of production. And you may have heard this term before, but I think it's very important that for Marxists, class is not defined by how much you earn or if you went to university or if you have a car, but how you relate to production. And the capitalist class is made up of, yes, very rich individuals, but importantly, people who own and control significant productive resources, whether it's the raw materials or the factories or the mines, or whatever. And they compete on the market for profit. The working class, however, comprises of those whose only means of making a living is to sell their ability to work. So they don't own the resources or make the decisions about what is produced and why. And I think this is a very important starting point because it forms the basis of where power lies in capitalism. It's not just the individual greed of the capitalist that makes the world unequal, but the fact that a minority make all the decisions about even the, raw materials that are in the ground and, how and why they are used. Capitalism and the competition that's so inherent is important as well because making a lot of profit is not enough for capitalists. They have to make more profit than the next capitalist, and it means they have an immediate interest in outcompeting and destroying any competition they face. The state also is a really important part of capitalism. It uses force to protect the property and the interests of the capitalist class, like, using the cops, the courts, prisons. But it can also play, and I think it does, especially in a country like Australia, a very important ideological role by claiming to be neutral and about balancing, a nation's interests. But I think for radicals, we should see the state squarely as a tool of class domination. And a part class domination, not simply because it protects greedy individuals, but the fact that it upholds the capitalist right to profit, the capitalist right to have private property and accumulate. So, next kind of question to address is how can we fight back? So, we've got a different starting point, even though we agree that there's inequality. And there's kind of a range of kind of strategies within mutual aid that people talk about. And I'm going to talk about three. Firstly, replacing the functions of the state in a very direct way. So kind of, feed the hungry, house the homeless. Secondly, prefigurative politics. This kind of more agrees that society has to change, but kind of posits that if you act like you're in the society that you want and your community acts that way, you can manifest it into existence. And finally is movement or base building, which is kind of the often more radical sounding kind of version of mutual aid, because these people might acknowledge that the system has to be smashed or changed, fundamentally, but see mutual aid as the gateway for the masses into social movements. So I'm going to talk about the first one, replacing the functions of the state. And I'm going to spend the least amount of time on this one because I think it is the most right-wing and apolitical version of mutual aid. It's often described or kind of viewed as doing the work or about, meeting survival needs of people. But I think it's basically, when it's in this form, indistinguishable from charity, except where normally charity in capitalism is the rich giving to the poor, this is just the poor giving to the poor. I think this argument can seem like it has weight, especially because we've seen a collapse of the welfare state, and neoliberalism definitely, kind of encourages states to give less. But I think there's a really big problem with this sort of strategy, because even if every poor and working class person in the world pooled their wealth and resources, it still would not be enough. This is a fundamental part of the social position of the working class, is that they do not control the majority of the world's resources and money. And I think often the kind of insistence and like moralism around this thing of doing the work purposefully leaves questions unanswered of the root of the problem and also what ultimately needs to be done to get rid of inequality in the first place, not just make life a little bit nicer now. And with both of these problems, this form of mutual aid is compatible with capitalism. It doesn't demand anything of the state, and it doesn't even envision the massive amount of wealth expropriation from the bosses that would be necessary to get rid of inequality and actually build a better world. It basically lets the state and the capitalists off the hook and saying that we'll just, kind of deal with it ourselves. So now I want to talk about prefigurative politics. And this may or may not be a term people have come across before, but Winifred Briners has kind of she's a professor of sociology, and she was a activist on the New Left during the 60s and 70s. And she's given kind of a definition that I think kind of sums it up well. She explains that prefigurative politics centers on participatory democracy, understood as opposition to hierarchical and centralized organization. It requires a movement that develops and establishes relationships and political forms that prefigure the egalitarian and democratic society that it seeks to create. So, in other words, this strategy is about focusing on building counter institutions or communities within capitalism with the hope that they can eventually replace the state and replace a reliance on capitalism. Quite notably, Briners counterposes prefigurative politics to strategic politics. She says that strategic politics has at its center strategic thinking and the commitment to build formal organizations to achieve major structural changes. And prefigurative politics is opposed, opposed strategy to that. I think the way it relates to mutual aid is that it's kind of seen that by doing mutual aid in the correct way, so by not making demands on the state, not relying on government grants, you can eventually break people's reliance on the state and the capitalist class. So Dean Spade describes this as building the world we want and becoming the kind of people who could live in such a world together. I think this is basically just the new version of be the change you want to see in the world. I think it isn't enough to just be a nice person to challenge capitalism. And yeah, it misdiagnoses the problem and comes, I think, as a result to the wrong conclusion. The capitalist class and the state aren't just powerful because people rely on them, and they're not just powerful because people acknowledge the state exists. It's because it comes back to that kind of point of class being about an economic relationship. The capitalist class control and own everything that exists in the world. And I think it's not good enough, and it doesn't do anything to capitalism to exist or build in the cracks of the system or find a nicer way to live a life, for you and your immediate neighbors. But I think it has to be about power and where power comes from, and what we can actually do to smash the current system, not just kind of live alongside it. Now, non-hierarchical organizing is also, as Briners kind of said, that a central part of prefigurative and mutual aid politics. And kind of the emphasis of opposition to hierarchy and centralization is a big part of it. Now, capitalism is an obviously hierarchical system and totally non-representative. Even in Australia, apparently a great democracy, we vote every 3 to 4 years for representatives who are not accountable. But then, even beyond that, there is a huge amount of decisions that are made that we're never even asked to vote on. Like basically everything that happens in the economy, if we invade another country or if we send, weapons to Israel, etc. But I think the issue isn't hierarchy in an abstract sense. It's that the people making these decisions belong to the ruling class, and they make every decision that they do based on their interests of profit, their interests of power, in imperialism, etc. And I guess to give a counter example of how the problem isn't, hierarchy in the abstract, is I want to use an example from the Russian Revolution. So during the Russian Revolution, workers established councils, which are known as Soviets. And these were truly democratic bodies in a way that parliaments are not. Like, for instance, they had elections every 3 months, like, could you imagine? And there were procedures that enforced the right to recall representatives. But it was also a system of delegates. So factories had their own councils, but then from factories, they would elect delegates to their local Soviet, and delegates from the local Soviet could be elected to higher bodies. This is a hierarchy, like, just objectively. But the existence of this hierarchy was open and its functioning was explicit. It was about coordinating the efforts during the Russian Revolution to both defend against the counter-revolution, but also build socialism. There were democratic mechanisms to control it, but quite importantly, there was the political question of every delegate in the Soviet was a worker who still was a worker, and they were a member of the class who actually has the interest to build an egalitarian world. So then there's kind of the question of centralization as well. And I think this is a very important strategic question for both movements that we participate now in capitalism, but also the world we want to build and live in. But I'll talk about that latter point a bit further on in my talk. Talking about movements, centralized movements have historically been more effective in both attaining their goals, but also empowering more people, ordinary people and workers. So a couple examples, you know, the 1963 March on Washington during the Civil Rights Movement, that's an extremely centralized action, or giant moratoriums against the Vietnam War, or even the massive protests that happened for Palestine across the past couple of weeks in Australia. I think the effect, the political effect of that has meant that hundreds of thousands of people who maybe otherwise would have been convinced of Labour's sort of like recognition thing have seen there's actually an alternative, that we keep marching, we keep fighting for Palestine. And I think centralization really importantly speaks to who you view as the agent of change. For Marxists, as I've talked about, it's the working class. And the working class is not powerful as individuals everywhere, but as a collective class. And they're not powerful. The working class is not, you know, powerful if they're just individuals who participate in mutual aid projects or as citizens, you know, who vote or whatever, but when they take action collectively. So I think similar to the question of hierarchy, it's very easy to kind of throw the baby out with the bathwater. People, you know, can reject centralization in the first place because they're worried about, you know, people who, I don't know, like the government, the way the government operates or whatever, people having undue power. But I think any movement is going to be have debates and it's going to have democracy. But I think when we're talking about a strategy that can actually affect capitalism, that can actually challenge and overthrow capitalism, an abstract moral opposition to hierarchy and organization has and will lead to defeat. Because the capitalist class is certainly very well organized. I think in response to that, the left has to be basically out-organize them constantly. And this kind of relates to the final strategy of mutual aid I want to talk about, which is base or movement building. I think this can seem like a more left-wing version of these politics, you know, often associated with anarchists, and a particular example I want to talk about, you know, associated with the Black Panther Party. And now this kind of strategy does acknowledge that there's a need to confront the system. And so it is different in that way to prefigurative politics. But according to people who advocate for, you know, base or movement building, the masses aren't capable of just directly engaging in theory or political debate or being directly convinced of a political position. So instead of talking about politics, the left should try and directly meet the needs of the impoverished and the oppressed and do a better job than the capitalists and government do. And that's the way we can build, you know, our movement. I think part of the argument is just that thing of it's easier to get people to come to you if you're giving them something free rather than making a hard political argument about why they need to engage in politics. And I think the kind of most frequently used positive example of this is the Black Panther Party and their free breakfast programs and other community services. I mean, first of all, this is definitely not all the Black Panther Party did. They ran a number of extremely high profile and successful campaigns as a part of the broader civil rights movement, including, you know, one campaign about, you know, called Free Huey campaign that was about one of their, you know, leading members who was locked up. That involved, and that movement involved, not just Black Panther activists, but, you know, civil rights activists from around the country. But also, and I'm going to talk kind of about this in more detail, but the Black Panthers were definitely not an organization that was primarily focused on mutual aid. Their main proposition was the arming of the poor Black community for self-defense against state violence. And this approach had its own problems. But I think the charitable programs that the Black Panthers ran complemented their approach of, you know, arming the poor Black community. As leading Black Panther Fred Hampton wrote, when people have got a problem, they come to the Black Panther Party for help, and that's good. Because like Mao says, we are supposed to be ridden down the path of the social revolution, and that's for the people. So it was a very intentional, I guess, the way that they approached it. But I think it raised very real problems for the Black Panthers and kind of reveals more about even what kind of the best version of this strategy can kind of result in. I think the first thing to say about, you know, base or organization building through charitable distribution is the kind of people who are attracted to this approach and on what basis they are attracted. So you bring together the poorest, most downtrodden sections of society, and you relate to them at their most vulnerable and most dependent point. For socialists, the reason we orient to the working class, who are the largest oppressed group in the world, is not just because they are oppressed and they are poor, but because they have a latent power.
And we want to relate to workers where they have that power and where they have that strength. So again, not as, you know, individual workers, but workers as a collective class at work, engaging industrial action and challenging the system. I think there is importance to this sort of orientation because, you know, firstly, when workers take these actions, even when they, you know, not participating in a revolution, it confirms and builds the argument that ordinary people are capable of changing society themselves. And also, and very importantly, because this strategy of looking to people where they have power, you know, the working class at work taking collective action, is the only thing that can actually defeat capitalism. Because, you know, leveraging the power of the working class actually stops the economy and can hold the system to ransom. There's a pretty common phrase that comes up, this idea of solidarity, not charity. But I think even when it's a political organization that's engaging in mutual aid, this approach is basically charity. Because free medical services or free or food distribution do not activate people in the same way, and they don't give ordinary people agency to actually fight against their own oppression. And I think the relationship built between peoples and organizations, you know, who participate in this sort of mutual aid is one of dependence rather than one of political commitment and strategy. And for that reason, it might as well just be, you know, Vinny's giving out the food, because you're not actually arguing to people that they engage with your group on a political basis. And this was a very big problem for the Black Panthers. Their free breakfast was extremely popular and is talked about a lot, but it didn't increase the amount of self-organization of the poor. And actually, you know, like later on, didn't help protect the Black Panther Party against the repression from the state. The Black Panthers were intentional in orienting to a section of society that Marxists sometimes talk about as the lumpen proletariat. Now, this term describes those who are totally disconnected from production. So the permanently unemployed, you know, petty criminals, the homeless, and that sort of thing. And for the Black Panthers, base building was kind of part and partial to an orientation to people on the fringes of society rather than orienting to the working class in America. Even though people who, you know, are the lumpen proletariat or extremely poor are obviously oppressed by capitalism, it's extremely hard for them to have power and be organized in a way that can actually challenge the system. And going back to the kind of the strategy of, you know, arming poor people, the Black Panthers did not have a Marxist approach. They did not have an approach of building among workers. And because they, you know, kind of were, yeah, focusing on building an armed organization, recruiting from urban ghettos rather than talking to militant Black or white workers fit based with this approach. Leading Black Panthers actually pretty quickly realized the problems this was presenting for the organization. So leading Panther Bobby Seale lamented the type of Panther who, quote, identified only with the gun, who centers things only around himself. He's still selfish. He thinks his pot and wine are above the party. He thinks his gun is something that he can use at will to rip off stuff for himself. So basically, they were acknowledging that through their strategy, they weren't convincing people of revolution. They weren't convincing people to be loyal to the Black Panthers because of their strategy of liberation. But they were, you know, recruiting people who actually don't have a collective interest like the working class does. And because the Black Panthers were already facing extreme state repression and were relying on basically recruiting people straight from jail or petty criminals, it basically accelerated their downfall as a national organization. And like I said, the popularity of things like, you know, free breakfast programs or handing out clothes and shoes didn't do anything to even slow down the state repression that the Black Panthers were facing. It, you know, receiving, you know, donations from the party wasn't reaching people, you know, where they have power, but also ultimately, you know, if they had oriented to workers or something like that, you could imagine a world where there could be strikes in response to repression. But instead, the Black Panthers were full of, you know, police spies and were, you know, destroyed within 10 years of becoming a national force. I think the Panthers are, you know, obviously a very inspiring example that people look to in a kind of a period of amazing struggle in the US. And they were a very serious political organization made up of, you know, countless activists who were very serious about fighting for revolution. But I think aiming for revolution, aiming for the overthrow of the system, means being serious about the type of organization that you build and having an analysis of who has power in order to actually win. And like I said, many of the people who were recruited to the Black Panther Party, you know, were not recruited on the basis of a political perspective of needing revolution. And I think, this another kind of reason to unpack the Black Panthers, and you could spend like, you know, hours and hours talking about, you know, just this example, but it's also because I think they're an example that people try and pair both the argument for mutual aid with the argument that it kind of goes with social movements. Mm-hmm. So Dean Spade, to go back to our old friend there, says that strike funds or kitchens are an example, you know, strike kitchens are an example of successful mutual aid. But I think there's a big problem in equivocating the two strategies. The thing that makes a strike successful is not the strike kitchen, it's that workers are using their industrial position to stop the economy. So often the kind of best cited examples of mutual aid, like kind of even the Black Panthers, actually just reflect the success of a social movement or a radical mood, you know, or reflect the success of industrial struggle, not the other way around. But I do just want to point out that even for the most kind of left-wing variants of mutual aid, working class struggle is only an afterthought or kind of a complement to the main game of community building. So in the words of Dean Spade, while social movements are good, our ability to build mutual aid will determine whether we win the world we long for or dive further into crisis. And I think all of this is quite like different, like actually totally opposed to Marxism in the key sense of not seeing workers as the potential, you know, self-conscious agents of change. So I think, by not looking to workers as the agent of change, a lot of the time mutual aid can also end up just being a bit of a top-down politics about a small group of people who have the right ideas being able to change the world. And I think this kind of leads to the last point. And, you know, they're all connected. I think what you see is the problem, you know, why the world is the way it is, who you look to as the force for change, will influence what you think is the ultimate solution to the problem. So if we take mutual aid at its best, like where some people do want to see a new society, the kind of way they envision the reorganization of society is very different to how Marxists envision it. So for Dean Spade, to get to a society organized by collective self-determination, we need to scale up mutual aid projects to a point where everyone has what they need, et cetera. Now, you may think, does scaling up mean every mutual aid project kind of grows larger and encompasses all of society? No. Scaling up doesn't mean merging mutual aid into one organization across a region or a state or a country. It just means building more individual mutual aid groups in neighborhoods and communities and copying each other's best practices and adapting them to work for particular neighborhoods, subcultures, and enclaves. But there's a very big issue here, which is that the problems of capitalism are not problems of neighborhoods, subcultures, or enclaves. They span the entire capitalist system. In other words, the entire world. Global inequality, imperialism, the climate crisis, the rise of the far right, etc., cannot be solved on a local level. Capitalism just cannot be challenged on a local neighborhood level. So if we kind of envision, like thinking about the world we envision, how could global supply chains such as that for like life-saving medicine, etc., be coordinated if it's just about individual mutual aid projects in a community? Would each neighborhood have to apply for access to insulin? Or is every neighborhood going to have a factory that makes insulin? Or how about responding to climate change? I think to actually resolve the issues of climate change, you need to abolish the fossil fuel industry and overhaul basically every part of production. I don't think a local community can overhaul the way that, you know, things are managed in capitalism with shipping lanes all over the world. We can't, you know, just do that from like the Gap or something. So I think if we want to smash the capitalist states and capitalist class as a whole, we need a coordinated struggle of the international working class. And that is an absolute essential, I think, not an optional extra to reorganizing our neighborhoods. And I think if we go back to the Russian Revolution as an example, we can see that it is possible, but it's a huge task. It involved the active involvement and coordination and opinions of millions of workers who were organized in their cities, in their Soviets. And it required things like the coordination of arms to defend against counter-revolution. And it required tens of thousands of revolutionaries to argue that Russian workers could and should do away with capitalism as a whole, rather than settling for something in between or settling for bourgeois democracy. I think mutual aid basically says that there's an alternative to this, and it's small mutual aid projects. But I think the proof is actually in the pudding. There actually are plenty of proponents of mutual aid who are doing mutual aid correctly, if that can be a thing. That is decentralized, it's uncoordinated, it's non-hierarchical and horizontal, and it leaves absolutely no mark on capitalism as a system. And it actually basically hasn't been proven to build movements in any meaningful way. I think most people who say they are for mutual aid do genuinely desire to change something about the fucked world we live in. But I think it's often on the basis that revolution is too far off to be a serious proposal for change. And it's understandable why people might feel this way. But Marxism is not a politics of blind faith in an eventual revolution or a politics of waiting around. Our revolutionary politics comes from the analysis that firstly, the world can't be reformed to be nicer, but also that revolution is possible because of the existence of a global working class. I think most of what is conducted as mutual aid is just straightforward charity. And Marxists don't argue that all charity should be abolished tomorrow, but it's about understanding that charity or service provision does not challenge the system, let alone being enough to actually smash the system. And I think being deadly serious about fighting for a revolution does mean doing things right now, like fighting every single injustice that the system throws at us. And I think even when we know these battles won't overthrow capitalism, it's about looking to the force that can actually overthrow capitalism. It's about orienting to a force that can fight for themselves and fight for all of the oppressed. So I think for anyone who agrees that capitalism is an evil system, so I'm sure most people in the room, I think we have to be very real and very serious about what it's going to take to actually win a world that's worth living in.